and they're going to take up Johnson v. Zimmer and Mr. Walker.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Court Walker, and I represent the appellant Tanya Johnson, who is seeking to have her children and stepchildren counted as whole individuals under the bankruptcy code. Your Honors, the bankruptcy code does not divide individuals into fractions. There's no such thing as partial persons.
And is this the first case that's ever done this?
No, Your Honor, it's not the first, but I know of only this case and another, a case out of the Eastern District of Virginia, a bankruptcy court called N. Ray Robinson. And our court below actually...
But I mean, how many other bankruptcy court cases are there that have taken the view that have divided the individuals into fractions?
Only this, the opinion in this case and in the N. Ray Robinson case. Those are the only cases that I know of, Your Honor, where individuals have been divided into fractions under the bankruptcy code. There have been other cases which have adopted the economic unit approach that the bankruptcy court below adopted, but those cases, such as N. Ray Jewell, N. Ray Herbert, N. Ray Morrison, did not go this next step of dividing individuals into fractions.
How did it do it?
Your Honor, they adopted...
Rounded them off? Did it round them off?
No, Your Honor, those cases adopted the economic unit approach and viewed the debtors and the other individuals involved in the case as whole persons. And the economic unit approach looks for elements of support and dependency and intermingling of funds. But once those elements are found, appellant argues, first of all, that a heads-on-bed approach or a common ordinary definition of the word household should be applied. But if this court would adopt the economic unit approach, then appellant argues that it would be only appropriate to take the straightforward view of looking for dependency, support, and intermingling of funds, and at that point then stopping the analysis and the inquiry and saying these individuals function as an economic unit and make up a household. The reason why...
What are there, three different ways you could count them?
Lower courts have approached a situation like this under three different tests or three different approaches.
There's a census approach.
There's a U.S. Census Bureau definition of household, which some courts have adopted. There's an economic...
That's what you're posting in this case as your first choice.
Your Honor, really as our first choice, we would like to see the common ordinary definition of household identified and applied.
Is that the one the IRS uses?
No, Your Honor. The common ordinary...
So you're advocating for a fourth one then?
No, Your Honor. The common ordinary definition of household is best engendered in the U.S. Census Bureau definition. And that's why the lower courts that have taken the route that we're arguing end up saying the U.S. Census Bureau definition is the one we are going to go with.
And the criticism of that approach has been it has no relationship to economic reality or to what the debtor's disposable income and expenses are. It just happens to be that you count how many folks happen to run through that particular dwelling.
That is a criticism of the approach, but Congress did not give the word household a technical definition in the statute. And so, under tried and
that's
true...
That's the problem in this case. Congress didn't do much but write a sloppy statute.
Well, the sloppiness
why
of the...
Why isn't that a fatal criticism of the heads on beds? Because you could be somebody, for example, it could work to the detriment of debtors. Because it could be someone that a debtor supported, but maybe the child the dependent lived next door. And the fact that it didn't have the head on the bed, it could still be next door, and the debtor could have supported it. And conversely, somebody could have their head on the bed, and then somebody across town could be providing all the economic support. So why, in that case, should a debtor get credit for supporting somebody he or she is not? And so You've got a test here with the heads on beds and households and the Census Bureau that sometimes it would really harm debtors. Sometimes it would harm creditors. And but it seems to me Judge Agee's is correct that it doesn't bear any relationship to what the economic reality that chapter 13 tries to capture. I don't know which of these other, but that seems to me to be the worst of all these approaches.
Your Honor, if I may respond to your observation first and then to go back to Judge Agee. First of all, I do think you're correct, Judge Wilkerson, in saying that sometimes this may be debtor-friendly, sometimes this may be creditor-friendly. Our position is not that we're trying to adopt or argue for necessarily a debtor-friendly approach. We're trying to say that under...
No, I mean, it could. But your approach could be harmful to debtors. It could be, in many instances, it could be unduly generous, but in many instances, it could be quite harmful to debtors. Because they wouldn't get credit for somebody they actually supported simply because that individual lived next door. And that's not fair to the debtor. Conversely, it's not fair to the creditor to give the debtor credit for somebody the debtor has no role in supporting. So I just don't see this heads on beds approach. I don't understand how it got going.
I think regardless of the approach that this court chooses to go with, in some situations, it's going to be debtor-friendly. In some situations, it's going to be creditor-friendly.
Right, but why should we go with something that's that arbitrary, where the statute doesn't require it?
I don't think that it's a question of arbitrariness. I think that when a statutory text is going to be interpreted,
isn't your stronger textual point the fact that the statute uses terms that appear to relate to whole individuals and not to fractionated individuals? I mean, the first section, which is 1325, uses the term individuals. It doesn't
Absolutely.
Use part and two-thirds of an individuals. And then the 707B2 talks about dependents, and they're not fractionated individuals either. And the Internal Revenue Code and the Census, they don't deal, as far as I know, in fractionated individuals. And when I fill out my tax return, I don't claim a tax credit for 2¾ people.
Absolutely.
I mean, they either are dependents or they aren't.
Absolutely.
So where do we get the idea of slicing individuals into little bits and pieces when Congress uses the word individuals and Congress uses the word dependent?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that is the most important, the central issue that appellant brings before this court. And appellant argued to the lower court the heads-on-bed approach, but practitioners need to know the answer. Is it really a heads-on-bed approach? Is it an economic union approach? But the most central issue...
Maybe there needs to be some flexibility. Yeah. Maybe one test is better in case A, and another one's better in the next case, and another one's better in the following case.
So tell us what's wrong with what the bankruptcy court did in this case.
Well, exactly what Judge Wilkerson was just referring to, the fractioning of individuals. There's nothing that Congress
put... But then he rounds them back off. He uses that for a calculation purpose. He doesn't divide people up. He divides the support up. Like, if you got joint custody, 50-50, and that happens a lot anymore in the realities of life, and each parent provides 50% of the support. But for the counting this, you could, if there were two of them, you could put it together and have a one, right? Rather than
You're right.
two.
This is not an unusual case, Your Honor, because there are blended families that we come across day in and day out. When we interpret a statute, though, we go to the text itself and ask, what does the text say and what did Congress write?
But if he rounds them off into whole individuals, what's the difficulty with that?
Because it ends up placing an extra burden on the debtor.
He doesn't actually do fractional calculations in determining what the deductions are, does he?
Yes, in the sense that that is factored in when the debtor goes to the deductions. I mean, the fractions are what...
How would you do it if you were using the economic unit approach and you didn't have some fractionated method and you have a debtor who pays 51% of the expenses of child X, who would be a dependent, presumably for income tax purposes. But in effect, if you count them as a whole dependent part of the household, the debtor then gets the advantage of 100% of the expenses, but they're only paying barely half.
Yes, Your Honor, because that's the formula, though, that Congress laid out. And if I might draw a comparison to the ransom case that the Supreme Court decided.
Well, Congress laid it out. I'm not sure you'd have all these different approaches. And you'd have something in the legislative history perhaps that would have told us about that. But it looks like to me Congress just kind of slapped it all together, and that's why we're here.
Your Honor, if I may talk about ransom, though, in the ransom case, the Supreme Court took up the issue of whether the debtor was able to take the allowance of the vehicle ownership deduction once the debtor went to 707B and the means test. And in ransom, the court recognized that the debtor in that case had no ownership expense. There was no lien on the car. There was no loan that the debtor had to pay on monthly. And so it went through its analytical framework and its statutory analysis, defining the word applicable, and it said that that debtor does not get to claim any allowance for that vehicle ownership. But since ransom, lower courts have decided that when a debtor only has a small loan on a vehicle and makes a small monthly payment on the vehicle, they get to take the full allowance that's allowed under 707B. They get to take the full allowance because that's the formula that Congress laid out. And so in this situation, there may be some instances where debtors may get to take a full allowance even though a child is not having their head on the bed every night.
What did the bankruptcy court do with the fractions once the bankruptcy court found them?
The bankruptcy court then denied confirmation of the debtor's plan and said that the debtor could propose a new plan based on a household of five individuals instead of a household of seven.
But to get there, once the determination, the fractional determination was made, the bankruptcy court rounded up, so you were dealing with whole persons, even though they may not, they were fractionated to get there. You weren't doing a calculation based on 4.5, it was based on a whole number, five.
After the fraction was determined, then yes, he did round it up to a whole number. He concluded that the stepchildren in this case, three of them, were each 0.49 individuals, and the two sons of the debtor were 0.56. Added that all together and arrived at 2.59.
But as long as the fractions are rounded out to entire individuals in the calculation, what's wrong with that?
Because it still doesn't follow the plain language of the statute that
Congress
set forth.
Why not? If in the end they are individuals, or if in the end they are either dependents or not. I mean, because in the tax code, you have a definition of dependency where you provide over half of the support, but you don't use the fraction in the calculation. You know, you either are a dependent or you're not.
But once this number is arrived at, it is used to calculate how much a debtor needs to pay to fund a plan. And it's used to determine whether a debtor is above median income or below median income. So there are very significant ramifications to the debtor and to the case once this number has been arrived at based on the fractions.
So what do you think, that the bankruptcy judge should have used the fractions in the calculation?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that...
But what should the bankruptcy court have done?
The bankruptcy court should have read the statute and interpreted it for its plain meaning And a plain, common definition of the word household that Congress used is all the people, related and unrelated, who occupy a housing unit. And those are whole individuals, whole persons.
So you want the heads on beds?
That's right.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, well, let's assume we are not going to do that. Take us back to this economic interest concept or economic unit concept. And you've argued that other bankruptcy courts didn't go quite this far. So if we were to use that method, as if I'm recalling your brief, you were advocating for a different way to apply it. So tell us quickly what that is.
Well, I wouldn't say a different way to apply it, but I would say a straightforward way to apply it. If the court adopts the economic unit approach, then the cases such as In re Morrison, In re Jewell, In re Herbert adopted that economic unit approach.
How would that apply in your viewpoint in this case?
The court would simply look for elements of dependency, support, intermingling of funds, and if that is found, then the conclusion would be these individuals operate as an economic unit.
And that would be true if the debtor provided 2% of the expenses for a particular individual. They get counted as a whole.
Your Honor, to be quite honest, I think the economic unit approach, because it's not tied to the common ordinary definition of a word, lends itself to judges and courts filling in those types of gaps. So, such as in the case of In re Morrison, the court said, well, there's 7 non-exclusive factors that I'm going to look at on a case-by-case basis. So in the hypothetical that you're talking about, I believe a court would say, is this reasonable or unreasonable?
Did Congress adopt the Census Bureau's definition of household?
I'm sorry, did you say could or did it?
Did it.
No, Your Honor, it did not.
All right, well, given the fact that Congress hasn't adopted any of these theories, it hasn't adopted any one of these definitions, why don't we give, as Judge King says, give the bankruptcy judges a little bit of flexibility?
Because, Your Honor, rules of statutory construction say that when you're interpreting statutory text that has been left undefined by Congress, you look at the plain, common, ordinary meaning of the word.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Wickham.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Doug Wickham, and I represent William Zimmer. With me is Scott Kirk, the staff attorney for the Bankruptcy Administrator of the Eastern District of North Carolina. What I want to do is to address succinctly why Judge Leonard's interpretative approach got us to the correct and fair and right decision in this case. And Mr. Kirk, will address the broader policy questions and implications.
How did he use the fractions? Before he actually went into the calculation of how many dependents there were under 707, he rounded off?
He did in the end of the analysis, but if I could put it in the context of the case, I think maybe we'll all understand it a little better and understand why at least Judge Leonard reached the correct decision not to confirm the plan below. Because Tanya Johnson chose Chapter 13, her plan proposed to pay nothing to unsecured creditors. Excuse me. Among those creditors was her ex-husband, William Zimmer, to whom she was obliged to hold harmless on a truck loan that she had kept in their property settlement, but later let go and it got repossessed and created a deficiency. And they're both on the note. In Chapter 7, if she had filed a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, she could pay nothing to creditors and discharge her obligation to the credit union that had that note, but she could not, in Chapter 7, discharge her property settlement obligation to hold William Zimmer harmless on that thing if the credit union came after him. Now, in Chapter 13, if she can pay her creditors little or nothing. She can, if she successfully completes the Chapter 13 plan, discharge both of those obligations. It's why she chose Chapter 13. It's also why William Zimmer came to me and asked me to object to her plan. We urge on the bankruptcy court an approach to interpretation that we think reflects more accurately the reality of the situation.
What did you do with the fractions before?
Well,
the calculation. I'm interested in what you say, but I want my question answered. What did he do with once he got to the point where they are
2.59 on the facts?
Right.
He rounded up to 3 and ended up with a household of 5. That's what he did.
That was with 5 children.
Well, a household of 5.
No, wait a minute. There were 5 children.
That's right.
There were 5 children.
Right.
2 of them were 0.56 of support.
Yep.
3 of them were 0.49.
Yes.
Which came to 2.59 for all 5 children, which he rounded up to 3.
That's correct.
Added them to the 2 adults and came to a number of 5,
household of 5
for the 7 that were in the house.
Well,
for the economic reality, economic unit, right?
7 are in
but
the house.
But to answer Judge Wilkinson's question, he ascertained the aggregate of the fractions and then rounded up to the next whole number.
Yes, that's exactly what he did. Yes, exactly. Now, in this situation, and in Chapter 13, you have this form 22C calculation that says.
Wait. Why don't you just tell us succinctly now, why was that correct?
It was correct because the algorithm that provides the starting point, if you will, for projected disposable income in a Chapter 13 plan, the debtor had said, I've got 7. But we know that when children are not in the household full time, they don't eat, they don't use the water, they don't use the electricity, you wear and tear on the household. And the point of the 22C algorithm is to provide a statutory answer, because a number of the deductions, if you will, in that algorithm are based on a standard number based on a household size. And Tanya Johnson proposed a plan which in effect said, I should get credit for having a household size of 7 so that in the calculation, my starting point for what I have to pay to my unsecured creditors is 0. But if you take the economic unit approach and reality of the situation, you plug in household size 5 numbers, and the statute says she ought to be paying her unsecured creditors $653 a month.
Well, why can't you take, because very few bankruptcy court decisions have pursued it this way, why can't you take the economic unit approach? I mean, I agree with you on the heads on beds business that's probably not a good idea, but why can't you take an economic unit approach with respect to each individual and not divide them into fractions? Why can't you just say, you know, whether each single individual is supported or not?
In a number of the economic unit cases, the question is, is the individual either a member of the household or not? They were not based on these blended family situations that, as you've observed, are a more common reality.
But why isn't it Congress's job to update the statute to take advantage, you know, to reflect modern family situations?
Congress gave us a statute. Judge Leonard took an approach to interpreting that statute that provided, in this case, a much more accurate, realistic answer to the question of how much should she be paying her creditors.
Counsel, would you please allow the court to ask a question?
I apologize.
Why is it up to the bankruptcy judge to modernize the statute? Why can't the bankruptcy judge take a single individual and not fractionate the individual and basically decide whether that person is a dependent or not?
Because the economic unit approach in blended family situations, trying to reflect money that the debtor should be able to pay for household expenses versus toward unsecured creditors,
well, I'm just,
should take the approach that he took.
I'm still having problems with taking the word individuals in 1325 and dependents in 707 and treating them as fractionated units. I just, you know, that does that. I have two problems with it. One is a textual problem, and the other is a general view that, you know, if this is the way we're going to update the statute to, you know, reflect realities of modern family life, why that isn't a legislative exercise. That's the difficulty. At any rate,
I understand the difficulty. I think the best answer that I can give is that Judge Leonard had a case which had a blended family situation, and he had a statute which gave him certain words and terms.
Well, I mean, he
could. He interpreted it in this
please,
case.
Please, sir, you keep overriding the court. Please, your time has expired. Mr. Kirk.
Scott Kirk, I'm here on behalf of Mr. Browning, the successor intervener, and also on behalf of the bankruptcy administrator, Eastern District of North Carolina. I want to first start with, I've heard the court ask a lot of questions about, you know, fractionalization. And let me get to that. What we have here, Your Honor, is cases that I call pre-landing and post-landing, or pre-ransom and post-ransom. And what those cases done after they were decided was to instruct bankruptcy courts to now start looking at reality. This mechanical application of the means test needs to stop, and that we now need to start looking at whether they are paying this, whether they are can deduct this.
But then I have the question is, can't you use that economic reality? I mean, there's still some flexibility between the economic unit approach and the IRC definition of dependent, but can't you still give bankruptcy courts a degree of flexibility without treating individuals as fraction units?
And that's a good question, and it's hard to answer. What I can tell you is this: the growth of the economic unit approach started in Jewell and then hit with Herbert and Morrison. But those were cases in which we didn't have part-time household members, or we had household members that were contributing nothing to the household.
And I don't, you know, I don't object to the economic unit approach at all. And I'm not sure I object to, you know, doing the IRS's view of dependent, even though it's not incorporated. The point is, Congress hasn't really told us exactly how to proceed. But one thing I wonder if it has told us is that individuals are to be considered as units and as wholes. And that you can still... My chief problem is with the heads on beds approach, which I just think is completely divorced from economic reality. The others, not so much. Congress hasn't told us how to proceed. It hasn't locked this thing down for us. But I'm still having a problem with fractionating individuals and then adding them up and everything when I've got those words individuals and dependents and stature. Because I think we could run into trouble there, and I'm a little leery of ideas that bankruptcy judges or circuit judges or anybody else should be updating statutes in accord with modern times, unless Congress does so.
My response to that is, Your Honor, is that what we're dealing here is with an algorithm. We have a mathematical formula created by Congress in 2005. It's a poorly written statute, in my opinion, and we've got all kinds of holes in this statute that we've been trying to fill in since 2005. And the only way I can answer
some
that...
Some bankruptcy courts have filled that hole in by using a Internal Revenue Code approach, which is something sort of between the heads on beds and the economic reality. And nobody's really addressed that approach yet. Is that if the bankruptcy judge in this case had said, okay, well, I'm going to take that route, and if the individual qualifies as the dependent on the debtor's tax return, then they get counted as a whole person for determining household and a whole dependent. So what's wrong with that approach?
Your Honor, I think that's too narrow. That would be the most narrow approach you can have. In most divorcing families, and as someone who did some domestic relations work prior to taking this job, most people negotiate the tax refund or tax return dependency exemptions in their divorce decree. And what happens in those situations is...
reflecting on economic reality.
Exactly. You could have a mother in an odd year whose divorce decree says you can't claim the child, but the father can, and now we've got the household unit under 1325 being hijacked by a divorce decree.
Well, what is your thought as to the most helpful approach that doesn't require doing violence to the word individual or dependent? What in your judgment will best capture the economic reality short of playing games with those words in the statute?
If I can fine-tune that question a little bit, somebody up here's got to write an opinion. Mm-hmm. So if you could tell us how that might work, it sure would be helpful.
Well, in my opinion, Your Honors, fractionalization is not ideal. And I know Judge Leonard said that, and I know the judge in the Robinson case said that. They didn't want to have to do it that way.
A lot of bankruptcy courts have rejected it. Or they said it's not the way we want to go.
Exactly. But when you're dealing with a mathematical formula and the data going in it, that data can be corrupted if it's seven. It might not reflect reality.
The data can be corrupted. I just didn't hear that.
I said the data going into the algorithm may be corrupted if it's a household of seven because it's not actually a household of seven. And so what we have here is roughly $644 of national local standards that are being applied to a fictional household. And so this mathematical formula, while I don't think it's the best way to do it, but in a small, narrow number of cases, it may be the only way to do it. And here's the reasons why. When I explain the economic unit approach...
You don't think we should approve it, but we shouldn't outlaw it?
Exactly. It's these rare...
That ought to be a tool available to the bankruptcy court? Well, how can you... How could an opinion be constructed that would do that?
I don't know. But
you don't know. You're supposed to be here to help.
I'm just saying that this is the approach that I am advocating is the one that worked.
Well, but what I'm saying is, why can't we write and say, look, there's flexibility here. The understand the desire to have an approach that accords respect to economic reality. Maybe the economic unit approach would do it. Maybe the definition of the IRRC and the bankruptcy court has some flexibility. We're skeptical of the heads on beds, but you have to do it. You have to exercise the flexibility and give some respect to the fact that Congress wanted an individual and a dependent to be treated as a whole person. That's what I'm stumbling over.
Well, then you need to define household in such a manner that does not reflect the Census Bureau. Because even if you look at the Morrison decision that Judge Stock wrote, or I think Judge Waldrop out of the Middle District of North Carolina, In that decision, what we had here is we had a live-in boyfriend and girlfriend situation, which the debtor was to exclude the income and the economic activity of one party and call the household a one-person household. And what Waldrop said, no, you guys are functioning as one unit. You know, each one of you pays certain bills in the house and all that. So in Morrison, that was the case in that scenario. So even if you adopted the Morrison approach and say this household might be a seven-person household.
But if you take an individual and the question is whether the debtor should receive credit for the individual in trying to arrive at this ultimate figure of disposable income, okay? And why wouldn't an economic unit approach or the definition of dependency that the IRS, the Internal Revenue Code indicates, why wouldn't that allow you to arrive at an economically just result from the standpoint of debtors and creditors? And you could just say, by and large, if a debtor supports this individual and pays the majority of expenses or is part of the economic unit of the household, then we will count that individual as a whole individual for purposes of subtraction. But if there's only a little bit, then that doesn't count as an individual.
So not to interrupt, but if what I'm hearing is that we look at the definition of a dependent in the IRS and not adopt, say, if it's on your tax returns, that's a member of the household, but if it's not, it's not. What you're saying is that if we look at the definition of dependents under the IRS that and apply it into a bankruptcy scenario, is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, that in some cases you would. I would give the bankruptcy court a bit of flexibility. The problem is, the beds on bed strikes me as really introducing some unjust results, particularly from a debtor's standpoint, because you could be supporting somebody and it could be a major obligation of yours and you wouldn't get credit for it if it was a heads on beds approach. It seems to me it can be very unfair to a debtor. And similarly, somebody else could be supporting the head on the bed and the creditor, the debtor would get credit in providing zero support.
And the scenario I can give you that is like we discussed in my
office. The other approaches seem to be much more finely tuned, but I do think there's a real textual problem dealing with taking individuals and slicing and dicing them up in this way until Congress changes, you know, it can put, or any fraction thereof, or whatever.
Do you have a position?
Well, my position in the brief is that the economic unit approach worked here. Fractionalization is not ideal, but in this case it worked. In this position also is this: if there are expenses associated with part-time, what we're dealing here is really with part-time members of the household. We're not dealing with full-time. What they want to do is count them as full-time. These are really just part-time members of the household. So if there's expenses or other costs associated with these part-time members of the household, even in
make those in addition, can't you, under the test, and you get extraordinary expenses on top of the number of persons?
You get
can.
Medical, food, clothing, and line 60B, which in this case, and in Chapter 7, I think it's line 57, line 60, that's the catch-all. Like, you can go in and say, I've got the additional expenses associated with this child.
I mean, the statute does provide bankruptcy judges a good bit of leeway.
Correct.
So if we assume that we affirm the bankruptcy court in this case on these facts, next case comes up. Are we then applying an abuse of discretion standard in the future, say in case that comes up next, they use the Internal Revenue Code definition, and the court determines that that was the fairest thing in that case? Have we foreclosed that if we approve the bankruptcy court's methodology here?
Well, I mean, every, you know, as I cite in the brief, every one of these cases were very fact-specific cases, and they all turned on their particular facts, you know, and so if you adopt that, you know, the percentage, this, you know, slicing is, you said, slicing and dicing of children, would that be a blanket across the board for the entire circuit to do that? I think it would, unless the court said in this case-by-case analysis, maybe some language that would allow the court to keep the door open for an IRS approach or an IRS definition, or keep the economic unit definition but don't allow it and tell the court to go back and look at the IRS dependency laws.
Well, I don't know why we try to script it too finely.
Maybe we ought to dismiss this appeal. Leave it where it is.
Well, that's the court's discretion, but...
I don't know that it is. I don't know if we have authority to do that or not.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. And that was very helpful.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Wilkinson, in some of the comments that you were making in the previous argument, I believe that the appellant would be very satisfied with an opinion as what you described, with adopting the economic unit approach, but yet not taking it to that point of fractionalizing and dividing individuals. In essence, looking for elements of dependency, support, intermingling of funds, and deciding that, yes, this person is a whole individual under the household as Congress intended in 1325.
How would that help you in this case?
Well, Your Honor, because the two sons and three stepchildren, I believe there's indications that they are supported by the debtor, dependents of the debtor. There's intermingling of funds and expenses. And if that's not readily apparent from the record and stipulated facts that we have, then perhaps it's appropriate for the court to set the standard and then remand for the judge.
I don't know how the judge would sort it all out. I don't know. It could work in your favor. It could not.
It's
hard to say.
I think that under, if you will, that type of straightforward economic unit approach, then the debtor has a household size of 7, just as
I'm
we initially
sure
argued.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get that one, so
I'm not
going.
Sure.
Well,
I wouldn't be willing to say anything like that right now.
Be that as it may, I think that a couple things to respond to from the earlier argument is it was brought up that in these other cases that did not fractionalize individuals, the Jewell case, the Herbert case, the Morrison case, that blended families were not being dealt with in those cases. And that's true, but there were still ways that those courts could have resorted to some type of fractional piecemeal approach, but they didn't.
Nobody thinks it's ideal. I mean, we had the administrator saying, we don't think this is ideal. The courts don't think fractionalizing is a good way of going about it. I mean, as I go back to the tax code, you could fractionalize dependents, but we don't do it that way.
Right, and we don't believe that it should be done in bankruptcy.
Even though it might be a more accurate tool, because if you... you know, support somebody, maybe contribute 20% of their income, well, maybe you deserve 20% of a dependency deduction, but we don't do it that way.
And an appellant would say we shouldn't do it that way in bankruptcy court either. If we wanted just a reality or actual type situation just and go with that approach in and of itself, then all we would do really is look at Schedule I, income of the debtor, and Schedule J, expenses of the debtor, and find that she has a net monthly income of approximately $100, and that's what her Chapter 13 plan calls for. But Congress didn't say just look at Schedule I and Schedule J. Congress put a formula, an algorithm into place, and so that algorithm, that formula, doesn't always reflect reality in every instance, but what practitioners need is a clear rule to apply when someone walks in the office. We know how to deal with that household situation.
Maybe a clear rule doesn't fit everything, though.
Well, a clear enough rule to know whether we're applying an economic unit test, an IR dependency test.
Sounds to me like all three of the lawyers here today now support the economic unit test.
Well, Your Honor, we did.
You do. That's right. You came in here with something else, but now you're the economic unit. But you don't like, and nobody likes fractions. But the one we have on appeal is an economic unit test with fractions that have been rounded off.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in our brief.
Maybe that's the way you do it. You have economic unit with fractions that can be rounded off.
The with fractions part of that we would disagree with. But we did in our brief put as our first argument the ordinary common meaning of the word household. But in the alternative, we did brief the economic unit but without fractions. So, thank you, Your Honors. Unless there's other questions, that'll conclude my argument.
We will adjourn court. We thank you, and we'll come down and greet counsel. Mm-hmm.